All right, good morning. We are back in Genesis. Last week we did the Jacob, he's fled from Esau. He has met God at Bethel, which is the house of God. The heavens opened. He saw angels ascending and descending the ladder to heaven. We talked about the relationship between heaven and earth and the role of Jesus Christ, because he claims that angels will descend and ascend on him. And we talked about worship, how that works, because this is the temple, the house of God that he sets up. And then he moves in to meeting Laban, his soon-to-be father-in-law, and Rachel, his wife, and he is deceived by Laban. I thought it would help us to get a little bit of geography as we get started. The land that is the promised land is Canaan, and this will become Israel, Jerusalem. It will become the Holy Land later on. Egypt is down here, and we've been to Egypt already in Genesis, and we've come out. Babylon is roughly here. This is where Abram started his whole adventure. And Laban is Assyrian, so he lives up here. And the interesting thing about this geography is all these countries are going to come back up. The Syrian Empire is going to be one of the empires that destroys Israel in the future. And so Egypt, big name, Babylon, big name, Syria, big name. Esau is going to give birth to children that become Edom. And you have a whole book of the Bible dedicated to the destruction of Edom. And so these characters are, they're just starting now, but they're going to be important. And so we leave Canaan and we go to Syria to meet Laban. And when Jacob comes back, he's going to make a little roundabout way, and the river Jabbok is going to come up. And so, I mean, this is all proximate, but Jabbok is a river on the border on the east side. And anytime you come into the promised land, you come in from the east. If you're in Egypt, you can't just cut in straight here. Now you've got to go all the way around, come in from the east. It always happens that way, and it's the way you got in and out of the Garden of Eden. So Jacob has gone to Padam Aram to meet Laban, his mother's brother. And we just left Bethel. We anointed a pillar, said this would be God's house, and we're going to tithe in it since it's God's house. And we move to the next scene is a well scene, a well with water, fields, livestock, and women. We did this already when we met Rebecca. This is where you meet women, at wells. Anytime you're looking to find a wife, that's a good place to check. And it's also it's Edenic. It's Eden imagery. You have water, you have animals, you have stones. And we just left the temple, and so we've got both of those on our mind. And so we are... Jacob is looking to marry the right woman. We talked about that last week too. Esau marries the wrong women. He marries women outside of the covenant line who give his parents grief. So we want to marry the right women because we are Jacob. We are preserving the line, the covenant line. The promise resides on us. And so we meet Laban. We talked a little bit about him. And thing that comes out about Laban is he is a really bad guy. It's easy to have in your mind that Jacob is the bad guy because of the deception. And so anyone who Jacob is in conflict with, you're sympathetic to. That's the traditional default position, you're going to say. But Laban, of course, he tricks people too, so we know he's not really nice. But in Genesis 31, verse 41, it talks about Laban being changing all of his wages. He changed his wages 10 times. And later on, let's see, 15. In verse 15, it talks about that he has sold all of his daughter's money. Laban did not prepare money to take care of his children. So he's a very unsympathetic character. And the first thing he does is he deceives Jacob. He promises that he will allow him to marry Rachel, who is the beautiful wife. But he switches on him, and he gives him Leah, and Leah has weak eyes. She looks undesirable. It's not clear exactly what that means. I think it means perhaps almost unhealthy. She looks sick. She's not, I mean, it may be that she's just plain, but I think that the contrast is that she is not desirable, and Jacob doesn't really love her that much. He has kind of been stuck with her. And so in verse 31, After we've gotten into Jacob's marriage, he's been deceived, now he's got two wives. It mentions that the Lord saw that Leah was unloved. So God takes notice of her situation, so he opens her womb, but Rachel was barren. So God is taking mercy and love on Leah to give her children, and that'll be a way that she could perhaps win the affection of Jacob. She will become loved because in this time, children are very important, and especially important is the promised line, the seed of the woman who we've been waiting on. But we already know that Rachel is barren, and that's a clue. All the promised line women have been barren. Sarah was barren, Rebecca was barren, Rachel is barren. There will be more barren women in the future. Samuel's mother will be barren. Samson's mother will be barren. And John the Baptist's mother will have been barren. And then the Lord will open their wombs. It's a repeating theme. And the only thing more miraculous than causing a barren woman to give birth is, of course, causing a virgin to give birth. So Jesus is all the more miraculous. I mean, you know, barren women, I guess you could give them medicine these days. You could, strange things, unusual things happen. But a virgin to give birth, she's missing half the appropriate chromosomes, right? So that's especially difficult. And Jesus, of course, is that seed of the woman. He's the most miraculous. And so the Lord, he gives his favor on Leah, and she gives birth to four sons, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. And these are, of course, tribes of Israel. These are real people, but their families are going to make up these tribes. And so the first four are these, and then she stops at Judah. Rachel takes notice, and she doesn't have any children. She envies her sister now, and she says to Jacob, "Give me children or else I die." And Jacob's response here, I think, is the correct one. And it tells you about this whole problem of children in Genesis. He says, "Am I in the place of God who has withheld the fruit of your womb?" God is the one who gives these children. So every time these women are crafting up ways to have children apart from God's giving it to them, they are putting themselves in the place of God. And Jacob rightly rebukes that. He is not in the place of God. This is chapter 30, verse 2, where he gives the response. Only God can give these children. And so these plots are attempts to do God's providence on your own terms. Take it into your own hands to go early, not to wait, but to assume the role of God. And Jacob will not do that, but these women are persuasive, of course, and so they offer up their maidservants. And this is reminiscent again. Sarah did the same thing with Hagar. She couldn't give birth, and so she said, "Well, come up with a way to have children. Take my maidservant." And that doesn't work. That wasn't successful the last time, but we're trying it again. So she offers up Bilhah, and she bears a child. And, of course, this shows you, too, the connection. Rachel was going to take this child as her own. It says, "Bilhah will bear on my needs, that I may also have children by her." So the maidservant will be the actual birth mother, but then Rachel will assume the mothership. That's her way of playing God here. But it doesn't work. I mean, she produces a son, but he's not going to be the one we're waiting on. And so Bilhah has given Jacob, he does produce a son from her, and that is Dan. And there's a little description of his name. Rachel says, "God has judged my case. Therefore, she called his name Dan." And Dan means judge. Daniel, God's judge. El, we mentioned last week, El means God. Dan means judge, God's judge. And then Rachel's maid conceives again and bears a second son. And his name is Naphtali. So he is a great wrestling. He is the, "With great wrestlings, I have wrestled with my sister," is what Rachel says. And she's wrestling with her sister for the promise, and it just echoes of Jacob and Esau. They wrestled with one another for the promise. At their birth, Jacob reaches his hand out and grabs Esau's heel. He's been wrestling with him all along, and now we have the sisters that are wrestling with each other through this childbearing, through this feud to produce more children. And so when Leah saw that she was no longer bearing, she says, "Well, Rachel sent her maidservant over to bear I'll try it. So she sends Zilpah and gives her to Jacob as a wife. And so Zilpah bears a son, and his name is Gad. And then she bears a second son, and his name is Asher. And so you've got this real rivalry going on, this mimicry. The one daughter gives natural birth. The other daughter can't give birth, so she tries the maidservant. Well, then Leah realizes she's no longer giving natural birth, so she tries her maidservant. And this is all feud in order to win Jacob's affection and to be the dominant wife. And this teaches us a little bit about human psychology, does it not? That you have this tendency to battle and feud with those whom you think are your mirror image, your parallel. If you've got a sister, if you've got a brother, maybe you're the two children of your father and you want his affection, you fight, you battle it out. Rene Girard is a French psychologist, sociologist, and you may hear him cited by theologians. He's become popular now, and he came up with a theory to call it mimetic rivalry. And his book is called The Scapegoat. So his idea is that when society is in need of some sort of change, either they're desperate, maybe they're afraid, they find one character to sort of fight against, and all the people will group up in war against him. And usually, what Girard said, usually they pick the one almost just like them, the one closest to them, the one who would normally, you would assume, they would get along because they'd be the most alike, but that's a threat because he's taking your place, and so you get together. And so he talked, Girard was a fairly liberal Catholic, so some of his theology is not so hot, but he talked about how that worked out in the history of Europe, and he talked about how that works in the Bible. And so Jesus is the king of the Jews. He's the rabbi par excellence. Who wants to kill him? The rabbis, the leaders of the Jews. They're the ones that want him out. And so this happens in human psychology, and you see it in the Bible. Whenever you've got all these kids that they don't get along, they fight. And that's part of our dilemma because of sin. We fight about this, and it's part of something that Christ comes to heal. When Paul talks about unity and dwelling in bonds of love in the Spirit or being one body, it's not just kind of sweet talk. It's not, let's all get along. That's the problem that's been going on in Genesis. All these people are fighting and warring against those who ought to be their friends, their family. It's a real dilemma. And so when Jesus heals that, that's not a second-order issue. It's not a peripheral issue. It's a major problem of world history. Jesus comes, and of course, he has to be the one that dies in order to bring this about. So part of redemption is putting away this rivalry, but it's still with us as long as sin is with us. So it's something to take note of in your own life. If you find yourself picking out people you especially don't like, maybe you should ask yourself, is there something about them that reflects your own position in life? Right? Is there something about that person that tells you about you? That's why you're angry. You're threatened. It seems to be that is a reality, and you see it in some of these striving and wrestling matches in Genesis. So we've tried two maidservants now, and we've reached a pause, I suppose. Reuben, this is the original son of Leah, he went out in the days of the wheat harvest and found mandrakes in the field. And he brought them back to Leah. And now this is where you know it's Jacob and Esau all over again. Rachel says to Leah, please give me some of your son's mandrakes. I'm awfully hungry. And she says, is it a small matter, Leah saying to Rachel, that you have taken away my husband? Would you take away my son's mandrakes also? And Rachel said, therefore he will lie with you tonight for your son's mandrakes. It's a little bargain going on. In the next verse, verse 16, Jacob came out of the field in the evening, so he's coming back home from working in the field, and Leah went out to meet him and said, you must come in to me, for I have surely hired you. This is his wife talking, and she has hired him with her son's mandrakes, and he lay with her that night. So you've got this bargain over food, for the rights to bring about new life, a birthright, perhaps. And so it is exactly the Jacob and Esau story, only with these women now. And so it says that, but this is interesting, God listened to Leah. So God, again, taking notice of Leah. And she conceived and bore a fifth son. And Leah said, God has given me my wages. So making, again, that play, I've hired him with the mandrakes. Well, God has given me my wages because I have given my maid to my husband. So she called his name Issachar. And then Leah conceives again and bores a sixth son, and he is Zebulun. And then she bears a daughter named Dinah. So the sons are going to be children of Israel. Dinah is going to be a character that appears in a couple more chapters that we'll come across, but she's a daughter. And then verse 22, and I think that this is redemptive language, God remembered Rachel. Rachel has not had any kids of her own at this point. She's offered up her maidservant, but she's never had any herself. God remembered Rachel, and God listened to her and opened her womb. And she conceived and bore a son and said, God has taken away my reproach. So she called his name Joseph and said, the Lord shall add to me another son. And Joseph means to add, the addition, to acquire. God remembers her and takes away her reproach. Reproach means shame or even uncleanness. Reproach is taken away at Gilgal when we circumcised all the sons of Israel who had not been circumcised in the wilderness. It said, therefore they rolled away the reproach of Egypt. David, when he goes out to fight Goliath, he says, who is this uncircumcised Gentile? And then he says, I will roll away the reproach. And so that language, roll away the reproach, is getting rid of uncleanness or shame or affliction. And so Rachel has a reproach because she can't bear children. She, being the promised wife, the favored wife, can't have children. That's her reproach. That's her shame. But God takes it away, and he remembers her. And remember is a redemptive word. God looks at the rainbow, and he remembers. He looks at the memorial stones and remembers. He looks at the bread offering that is for a memorial, and he remembers. And he's remembering his own promises, because this is covenant stuff. He's made his promise in the covenant, and so he's remembering what he said he would do. And if he's a righteous God, then he will do what he said he will do. That's the idea. And of course, in the New Testament, we ask God to remember Jesus Christ when we break the bread and pour out the wine. As a memorial, it's the way I think it ought to be translated, but in remembrance of me, is it still works. And so we're asking God to remember, to save us, to take away our shame, to take away our reproach, because he promised that he would. It's not that you get to manipulate God, but once he says he's going to do it, he takes pleasure in you asking him to keep good on that, because he is a God who does keep good on it. So His wives have been wrestling here and fighting and trying to play God, bring about these children. And finally, it takes God remembering and stepping in to produce Joseph, who is the central son. Joseph is going to be the son that Jacob loves, but he's also the son that's chosen to do the redemptive task. He's going to finish off the book of Genesis. He's going to sit on the throne of Egypt, the most powerful man except for Pharaoh, and he's going to be the guy that does the talking for Pharaoh. And that's an important position. The one who sits at the right hand of the king is the one you interact with. He's the one that comes and tells you what the king's got to say, and you tell him something, and he tells it to the king. And so that's what Joseph's role is going to be at the end of this book. He's the promised son, but we couldn't bring him about. We had to wait for God to bring him about in his good time. And so it came to pass when Rachel had borne Joseph that Jacob said to Laban, send me away that I may go back to my own place in my own country. Give me my wives, my children, from whom I have served you, and let me go, for you know that my service which I have done for you. So he's like, I've been here long enough, Laban. I've worked for you. The original agreement was 7 years. Then he tacked on seven more for the second wife. And he said, finally, it's time to go. And Laban says, please, stay. If I have found favor in your eyes, for I have learned by experiences that the Lord has blessed me for your sake. And then he says, name me your wages, and I will give it to you. And so he doesn't want him to leave. Come on, you're doing a good job for me. The Lord is blessing me because of your sake. And that's another theme, that God blesses his righteous chosen man. It's Abraham at one point, it's Jacob here, it'll be Joseph later on. God blesses his righteous man, and everyone who is in proximity of him benefits from that. And that's something to keep in mind. You get blessed for his sake. For his sake, you get blessed. And so, we all know that that's going to happen with Jesus. We are blessed for Jesus' sake. But again, we've got pictures of that already in Genesis. And so we could have whole talks about that theme, but I just want to mention that it is occurring. It's occurred already with Abraham. God told Isaac, because of Abraham, I'm going to bless you. Laban's getting blessed here. Potiphar will be blessed because of Joseph. So Jacob says, "You know I've served you and how your livestock has been with me. For what you had before I came was very little, and it increased to a great amount. The Lord has blessed you since my coming. And now when shall I also provide for my own house?" He needs money now. The thing that we may not have noticed, Jacob isn't making profit here. He's not getting money. He's the one who's bringing in all of the cash, all of the provenance, all of the animals. But he's not getting any money. He's basically working as a slave. And this is bad. This is bad. He doesn't need to be a slave, but he's got to do his time as a slave. Sort of his time in the trenches, his time under a tutorial guardian. And it's hard to understand some of this, but I was reading, and back in 29:15, when they first had their little discussion about the wages, my translation says, "Because you are my relative, should you therefore serve me for nothing, tell me what should your wages be." That's what my New King James translates, "because you are my relative." Now, I was reading a few commentators, and they said that that doesn't work because relatives would not be hired servants. Remember the prodigal son? He wants to be a hired servant. Dad said, "No, you're my son. You're not a hired servant." So it's not because you're my relative you can be a hired servant. The commentators are saying that it's more of a, "Are you my relative? Are you really my relative?" It's a negative. They say that it's a, that the reason he's working for wages is because he's not been accepted as a true son. And I thought that was an interesting take. It would take some Hebrew work to determine that, but it seems to fit with what's going on with Laban. Laban didn't accept him as his own. He's been persecuting the whole time, treating him as a servant, a slave. And so Jacob has said, "Hey, it's time for me to provide for my own house now." He's ready to leave. And so Laban says, "What shall I give you?" And Jacob says, "Oh no, you're not going to give me anything. Except let me do this one last thing." He's tired of being in his pocket. And so Jacob comes up with a plan, which is pretty interesting. He says, "I will feed and keep your flocks. Let me pass through all your flock today, removing from them the speckled and spotted sheep, and all the brown ones from the lambs, and the spotted and speckled amongst the goats. These will be my wages. So my righteousness will answer for me in time to come when the subject of my wages comes before you. Everyone that is not speckled and spotted among the goats and brown among the lambs will be considered stolen." And this is very interesting because he says, "Don't pay me anything," because he's tired of being under his authority. "Let me simply take all the speckled and spotted and brown animals." The animals you don't want anyway. They're the weak animals. They're not going to be good for sacrifices in the future. They're not the pure, spotless lambs. "I'll take those away." And he says, "My righteousness will answer for me if this ever comes up. If you ever question me about this, anything that's not speckled or spotted or brown will be considered stolen, and you'll have grounds to prosecute me." And so righteousness is keeping faithful and honest to the terms of the agreement. I think that's something to understand. It's not, there's a lot of debate about what that word means. It's moral. It certainly is moral, and it's covenantal. It's agreement. Those two go together. Some people pose them apart, and then the other people don't like those people, and they continue to pose them apart, but they go together. It's moral, it's ethical, but it's also the terms of the agreement. Because if you break the terms of agreement, you're not an ethical guy. Makes sense, right? So if this ever comes up again, he says, "My righteousness will answer for me." And Laban says, "Oh, that it was according to your will. Sounds good to me. Take away all my undesirable animals." You know, that's great. And so he removed that day, Jacob removes that day, the males that were speckled and spotted, all the female goats that were speckled and spotted, everyone that had some white in it, and all the browns among the lambs. And then he put 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob, and Jacob fed the rest of Laban's flock. So Laban leaves, and Jacob's going to do this. And Jacob does this interesting scheme here. He takes rods of green poplar, of almond and chestnuts, peeled the white strips in them, and exposed the white, which is in the rods. And so he's making the rods speckled. You see, they're normally green and brown, so I'm going to tear little stripes of white in them to match my speckled goats, my spotted goats, my brown and white goats. He's gonna make these poplar reeds and almond reeds and chestnut reeds speckled and striped now. And the rods that he had peeled, he set before the flocks in the gutters and the watering troughs where the flocks came to drink so they could conceive after they drank. So the flocks conceived before the rods and the flocks, and they brought forth streaked and speckled and spotted. So you want speckled and spotted and streaked animals? Make speckled and spotted and streaked poplar rods, cedar rods, almond rods, and put them in front of them when they mate. It's not scientific, but it is symbolic, right? And so they do this, and it works, and all their kids come out this way. And so he's accumulating a lot of speckled and spotted and striped animals now, more than are not. And it came to pass, whenever the stronger livestock conceived, the healthier, stronger, more desirable, Jacob would put the rods in front of them. And so they conceive, speckled and spotted, but they're stronger. They look, you know, Laban's going to look at them and say, they're speckled and spotted, but they're actually stronger, bigger, more desirable, really. You could get more money from them, perhaps. They're worth more. But when the flocks were feeble, he did not put the rods in front of them. So the feeble ones went to Laban, and the stronger ones go to Jacob. And so thus the man became exceedingly prosperous. Jacob, this is, had large flocks, female and male servants, camels and donkeys. And to me, this is directly pointed at what Laban did to Jacob. Jacob said, I would like Rachel, the beautiful daughter, the more desirable daughter. And Laban tricks him by giving him the weak daughter, the daughter with the weak eyes. And then they proceed to have this sort of mating warfare contest. It's very bizarre. Well, now we're going to have this very bizarre ritual of all of these children of the herds being born, but it's the same sort of warfare. Jacob says, I'm going to make those that you tried to give me, I'm going to turn them into the stronger, the wealthier, the more desirable, and I'll be the prosperous because of this. And to top it off, it's the terms of the agreement, pal. They are speckled and striped. You said that all the speckled and stripes go to me. And so it's kind of the deception theme, but it's actually technically correct according to the agreement. So this is Jacob using wisdom. I mean, he's turning the situation against Laban in such a way that Laban agreed to it, in such a way that Laban has no cause to complain about it. And I think it's a really ingenious thing, and it can't be the case that Jacob has magic powers or that he's an apothecary who went out and found all the herbs that would make this happen. This is God's hand in all of this, and God's going to talk about that later on. In 31, Jacob is talking about this, and in verse 4 he says, he's retelling the story. He says, the God of my father has been with me. And then later on he says, in verse 31, verse 10, happened at the time when the flocks conceived, I lifted up my eyes and saw in a dream, and behold, the rams which leaped upon the flocks were streaked, speckled, and gray-spotted. Then the angel of God spoke to me in a dream, saying, Jacob. And I said, here I am. And he said, lift your eyes now and see, all the rams which leap on the flocks are streaked, speckled, and gray-spotted, for I have seen all that Laban is doing to you. So God said, I saw what Laban did to you, so I'm going to make this work out for your benefit. And he says, I'm the God of Bethel. Remember Bethel? Where you anointed the pillar, and you made a vow to me. Now arise and go out of this land, and return to the land of your family. So God says that I'm doing this. I saw the affliction on you. I remembered the vow at Bethel. I remembered the anointing of the pillar, and I kept good on it. And so now you are wealthy, and you're going to get to leave. And it's interesting because if you're just trying to read it surface level, you don't you may not put all those pieces together. That through Jacob's act with the reeds in front of the animals, that was God's means of providing justice because Laban had abused him earlier. That's an important element in this story. Laban is the bad guy who's been abusing Jacob. He's been oppressing Jacob. Jacob's been serving under tyrannical circumstances. And so God remembers him and blesses him and makes it so that he gets out of here. And that, again, will be the Exodus story in a nutshell. The same thing's going to happen to Israel. Scotty, did you have a question?
I'm wondering, I can't remember. Is there a distance between Laban and Jacob, the flocks?
Right, yes. After they made the agreement in chapter 30, when they're making the agreement, it says in verse 36, Laban put 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob. So Laban's 3 days away now, and he's going to end up pursuing Jacob because Jacob gets news that he's angry now. And so he's going to leave, but Laban's going to catch up with him. So yeah.
So the difference in the herds is not every day in front of him.
Right, Laban doesn't know what's going on, that how it's coming about this way. He made the agreement that you take care of my animals, and at the end of it all, you keep the speckled and spotted and striped ones. And the idea is you keep the runts. You keep the ones that didn't turn out that good. But Jacob has orchestrated this through God's providence so that the ones that would look like the runts visually, that appear to be speckled and spotted and striped and brown and white, are actually stronger, healthier, and more prosperous. And that's the genius of this story. This is the great reversal, and this is what we've previously been doing. But to me, this one is more detailed, and you get to pick up a little more about this warfare through means of covenants and through means of, I mean, we say deception, but I think the point of Genesis is it's blurring. The rank deception is on one end of the spectrum, and then the actual wise, crafty, you know, guy that writes up the contract, he's on the other end. And so, you know, perhaps at the furthest end of crude deception is sinful and wrong. But, you know, if you outsmart your opponent playing by the rules, that's not a sin at all, right? And so there's sort of this spectrum here. And the question of the deception is difficult because we don't want to endorse lying. But we do have to say that this is a theme that's all over Genesis. Every time you have the holy warfare, there's some means of ingenuity, wisdom, and fooling the other guy, however he gets fooled. That's always the point. And so it's going on here. And here, though, I mean, Jacob is even saying that his righteousness will answer for him. So he's confident that he's in the right. We've got one more fooling to go on, though, because as they leave, as Jacob gets his family to leave because he hears that Laban's angry, they take the idols with them. Miss Charlotte?
Sorry, I thought you were leaving that, but I was in 35, it says Laban took all the wife with charge of his sons. Does that mean that the sons then went with
Yeah, I think the sons are real. They're present because in chapter 31, Jacob overhears the Laban's sons talking, and he realizes that Laban's angry. Correct. So Laban's sons are sort of out there watching and maybe just making sure that everything's going okay. But obviously, they don't notice. I don't know that they notice everything that's going on until it's happened. I think once it's done, they're like, "Oh, wait a minute! He's got all the wealth." But yeah, they're sort of the overseers. They're looking out. And again, this is other evidence that he didn't receive Jacob as a son, because he's got his natural sons sort of watch guarding Jacob, you know. And so Jacob is clearly not the son at this point. That's right. And they say, "Jacob has taken away all that was our father's, and from our father he has acquired all of his wealth." But what's the irony there? Laban only got the wealth because of Jacob. Jacob said, you know, "All of the prosperity that you've gotten is because of me." And so now they're angry because he's taken the wealth back, but it was his to begin with. But there's a very complicated interaction here. That's what was fascinating. All of the details, all of the echoes, a little bit back to Jacob and Esau, but then a little bit back to the original Laban and Jacob agreement. And so they're going to leave now. Jacob says, "It's time to go." He says, I see your father's countenance is not favorable towards me, but the God of my father has been with me. And you will know with all my might that I served your father. This is the whole apology, his whole defense. Yet your father deceived me, changed my wages 10 times, but God did not allow him to hurt me. And that's the same thing that's going to happen as they flee. God's not going to allow Laban to hurt him either. And Rachel and Leah, in 31 verse 14, they say, hey, he didn't give us any money either. He took all our money away. He's no good. Is there any portion or inheritance for us in our father's house? Here it is. Are we not considered strangers by him? So they are not considered family anymore. They're strangers. They're servants. They're slaves. He has sold us and consumed our money. For all these riches which God has taken from our father are really ours and our children's. Now then, whatever God has said to you, do it. So they all agree. God has done this in such a way that we are getting our just rewards now. Laban was an evil man. He deceived us. But God looked out for us. So let's go. Let's leave. And so Jacob rose and now Jacob's an older man at this point. He's got sons now. He's got camels. When he gets to Jabbok to wrestle with God, which we may can get to briefly, he's 97 years old. This is an old guy. If you want to do a little fun with biblical chronology, you can do the math going on here. He's Joseph. You get all the dates with Joseph, so you do a little subtraction. Joseph was 30 when he stood before Pharaoh, Genesis 41, 46. So you get an age there. So at the end of the 7 years after that, he is 37, and he was 39 when Jacob was 130 years old. It's going to give you all these these numbers and ages in the Joseph account. So when Jacob was 130 years old, therefore he was 91 years old when Joseph was born. And so if that were the case, Jacob had served Laban 14 years when Joseph was born, Genesis 30, 25. Therefore he was 77 when he entered this whole business. And so Jacob served 6 more years after the 91. And so when he's leaving back into Canaan, he's 97. And that's in a book, Philip Morrow, The Wonders of Biblical Chronology. And it's pretty interesting. You can do the math. And it's not that we're overly scrupulous with the numbers, but it does help to realize how long this has been going on. And he's been working for a long time. He was young when he left his parents' house. He's not young anymore. He left his parents, you know, probably 30-ish, the age you begin your encounters. And now he's coming back at 97. He's an elder. He's an elder at this point. And so the idea is that when you're young, you've got to suffer. You've got to go through a lot of tribulation, a lot of tyranny even. You've got to sit under harsh rulership. Paul in Galatians says, when the heir to the promises is a son, he looks just like a slave. And he's got Israel on his mind. Israel had to be a slave in Egypt, even though they were the son of God. But when they grow up, when the son matures, he's no longer under that. And so we're getting to that point now. Jacob has grown up. He's no longer under that. So as he's leaving, Laban pursues him. And God stops Laban in a dream and says, be careful that you speak to Jacob neither good nor bad. So just back off, okay? He's under my care. And so when Laban finally overtakes Jacob, Laban says, what have you done? You've stolen away unknown to me, carried away my daughters like captives, taken with the sword. That's a lie, right? He didn't take his daughters with the sword. His daughters said, hey, we ought to get out of here. We've been being oppressed so far. So he's trying to be tough here. And he says, why did you flee away? Why didn't you tell me? I would have sent you off with joy, songs, a harp. It's all a lie. He wouldn't have done that. He would have said, stay even longer. Come on, a little longer. Don't leave. But so Jacob left. And so he said, well, God stopped me, and he told me not to do anything bad or good to you. But he said, but you have stolen my gods. Why did you do that? So he still wants more. And Jacob answers and said, I was afraid. That's why I left. But he said, but I didn't take your gods. And he said, come on, search and see. And we find out, of course, Rachel had taken the household gods, in verse 34. But she put them under the camel's saddle and sat on them. And so Laban comes in and she says, you know, I'd get up if I could, but this is the manner of the woman is upon me, and it'd be best if I just stay put. And so Laban leaves. Well, there's more of this deception imagery. She did that in order to keep the idols. And the idea of keeping the idols is that they're worth a lot of money, if nothing else. They're probably made out of gold and silver. This is part of this, hey, he took all of our money away. Let's get some of his now. Let's pillage him. Let's plunder him. And so Laban has to, he can't find anything. So Jacob is angry. He rebukes Laban. So he's got this opportunity now. Hey, you didn't find anything. Quit giving me a hard time. And Laban says, well, hey, let's make a covenant, and we won't fight anymore. You know, we'll just call a truce. So they make a covenant, and when they make the covenant, you get a lot of information. This is in 43, chapter 31, verse 43. They start talking about this. So to make a covenant, you get a witness. So the witness is the stone. We'll take a stone and put it up, and it's the witness. And then we get everybody around, and we are going to make our vows. He gathers them all around. Listen, let's make this agreement. The heap and pillar is the witness. You won't come past this point. I won't come past this point. It's the boundary. We're not going to fight anymore. And then Jacob offers up sacrifices on the mountain. They eat bread, and they stayed all night on the mountain. And then they departed in peace. So this covenant-making ceremony, get everybody together, you get a stone, a rock to be a witness, everybody hears your statements and agreements, then you make your sacrifice, you eat a meal, and you depart in peace. And that formula is a covenant formula, and it's a worship formula. And we're on a mountain when we're sacrificing, and remember, I think you can see this, we left our parents' house. We went to Syria and we struggled under harsh rulership. We make an exit in the night quickly to where he doesn't notice. He chases us because he doesn't want us getting away. God keeps him from killing us. We go up on a mountain and have a worship ceremony. That's the Exodus. That is the Exodus in a nutshell. And we're going to enter back in from the mountain. We're going to come into the Promised Land. We're about to come into the Promised Land. And so this is in the text, though, you have to be familiar with Exodus, and you see it better. But this is, again, setting the pictures, the images. He's getting us ready to understand the Exodus theme, because that's a huge issue in the life of Israel. And so you make the sacrifice on the mountain, get all your brothers together to eat bread, and then you depart in peace, and you have secured this agreement now. And so that's what we want to do in worship. We want to all get together. We want to make our vows, our agreements. We want to apologize for the wrongdoings, ask for forgiveness. And then we want to have ourselves as a living sacrifice unto God. And we want to break bread and have peace and unity and then depart. We do all of those things. And we do it on the holy mountain that is heavenly Jerusalem. I better stop here. We're going to get into the wrestling with God, but I think that that's a big enough topic to take perhaps a whole class in itself. We do have time for questions, if anyone has anything curious about. Yes, Scotty.
You said that this story is very detailed, and I was noticing. I asked a question about the bowl of soup or stew, mm-hmm. whether or not that was a transaction took place there, the selling of burnt offering.
Right.
It was just a symbol of what was already going to happen anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You see a lot of that throughout this whole story with the reeds
mm-hmm.
and with the stone and with all these things that if you wonder how much of this is Jacob's doing,
right.
how much of this is God's doing.
Mm-hmm.
Is God accomplishing all of this through these little signs and things that it looks like just a person
mm-hmm.
has come up with?
An yeah.
idea that they had with the deal that Rachel and Leah had
mm-hmm.
to about the mandrakes. Was that...
That's right. The Bible.
Did Joseph come about because of the mandrakes, or did the, you know?
Right. No, that's right. It tells us afterwards, hey, that was God doing it all along. But when we were starting off, we thought, well, this is just normal life, and this is people plotting, and, you know. And so, but after the fact, he said, oh, yeah, yeah, God came to me in a dream and told me all of that stuff. And so that's how you're sure that he was right in doing what he did. But as you read the story, you don't know that until the end. And it's kind of the same way throughout. Joseph says, you meant this for evil, talking to his brother, but God meant it for good. That's right. God's sovereignty, his predestination, works in such a way that you're still free and responsible and do what you want to do. And don't ask me to put that in a logical syllogism, but I can show it to you in these stories time and time again. That's right. Here and now in the present, you're Scotty, and you've got all these options available to you, and you sit down with your power of thinking and wisdom and planning, and you make the decision. And then when it works out right and you're a rich man, you say, oh yeah, yeah, God did that for me. Because God was always in control of this thing, but that didn't take away your role in it either, even though it's your job to recognize God's role as God, and you need to submit to him. You recognize that all good things come from God. The only way you can do anything good is from God. So therefore, when you do something good, you say, God did that for me. I mean, there's no way to harmonize that that's acceptable to our minds, because we want it to fit nice and neat and clean. But God is not like us. And I don't mean he's just a little different. I mean, he's of a totally incomprehensible nature. Yet, he's in such a way that when he does things, they work out comprehensibly in our lives, in our world, if that makes sense. You know, his ways are not our ways, yet our ways only exist because he made them.
So then do we say that the bamboo and the reeds were a factor that God used?
Right.
Maybe not scientifically,
yeah.
But somehow.
That's right. Yeah, I don't know what about a reed would cause that to happen. Nothing in and of itself. But God orchestrated it in such a way that they were instruments in history. And so that's a way you can think about things. It's not that any of the actual historical events in themselves could produce anything. But when God chooses to use them, then they actually do. That's right.
It reminds me of the mud that Jesus put in the
blind. Right. Right.
Did it even happen?
Mm-hmm. And that's why you have to be careful with the healing mechanisms. It's because it's never the thing in itself. It's only God's blessing on it. And as soon as you find some miracle healing tool and you decide, I'm going to tell the whole world about it and sell it, you're pretty sure God's going to stop using it at that point. Because the whole idea is that it's God that does these things. It's God that's in control, and you're trusting him to provide. And so, I don't know, that'd be something interesting to explore, that the way God works in history, your job is to rejoice and give him thanks, but as soon as you try to exploit it or make it yours, then you've missed the point, and you've stopped having faith, and God will stop using it. He does that with many things in the Old Testament worship. The golden serpent, the bronze serpent that was used as a historical instrument to save people from dying. As soon as they started burning incense to it and calling it names and bowing down to it, God destroys it because it's an idol at that point. And that's a fine line to walk. I mean, I've talked to Roman Catholics and they say, but God really does these things. And it's not appropriate to say, no, he doesn't. That's our tendency, is to say, no, he doesn't. You're a liar. You're deceived. No, God probably does use all sorts of things. And it's great. And the proper response is to give thanks to God. But as soon as you tie that thing down, as soon as you tell everybody about it and charge them $5 to see it, it's different now. It's changed. And it's an idol at that point. And I think we could see that in these things. If you started selling these strips of bamboo to everyone and saying, this will be a miracle growth hormone for your cows, you've missed it. It doesn't work anymore. God is not going to bless that. Yes.
So, baptism and the sacraments, would you put those in the same?
I would. That's a helpful way to understand the sacraments. The sacraments work as long as you're trusting on God to bring it about in his ways through his providence, and you give thanks for it, right? But as soon as you say that you, with the water, did it absolutely, then it's changed. But again, the proper reaction, not say that it doesn't do anything, that God won't do it, but you have to leave it up to Him. And so maybe that is a good reason to follow the Westminster Confession when it says, you know, that it's not so inseparably tied. You know, we're going to say all the positives up front. Baptism is a sign and seal, promise even, a guarantee. But not so inseparably tied that God can't do things in other ways. And so that's the fine rope you have to walk. The reaction against sacraments, people say, oh, well, you're becoming a magician. You're taking over God's job. And so they get rid of them, or they relegate them to once a year. Well, that's not appropriate. The appropriate thing is say, well, God made the promise, and I'm just going to trust Him. I'm going to believe Him. And I think that's the healthy way to think about that. You give them the proper respect because of God's role, but you never tie them down to your powers. You never tie them down to any particular minister or church's ability to do them. And if ever it comes about that you're not sure how it's working, you trust God. You know, you give the faith to God and say, He's going to bring this about in His good time. I'm going to do what He told me to do, which is raise them up in the truth and nurture of the Lord. So yes, that would be all of that. And all of this is the same question of providence and responsibility. The same question, predestination and human authority. That's the root of it. That's the root of it. You could put it in the church and in sacraments. You put it in the world and its power and fear mongering. You put it in, you know, and sort of health and wealth and its voodoo. I mean, but it's always the same question of God and man, creature, creator. How about that? We're Vantillians. We like the creature, creator distinction. Yes, Davey?
I was just going to mention, I mean, God warns about this in Deuteronomy. I bless you with all these things, you know, didn't say we did it ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where, and you know, this can happen to us. God can bless us materially, but as soon as we forget that God's blessing, it turns into materialism.
Right, absolutely.
Which is what's happened, you know, in our country.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. All good questions, good discussions. We'll have to close now and prepare for worship, so let's pray. Father in heaven, thank you for the book of Genesis, which is preparing us for the rest of your story, for redemption. We rejoice in your gospel that Jesus Christ came and brought us out of slavery, and He took the seat at the throne at your right hand to give us freedom and peace. And now we ask that you would enable us to be co-rulers, to wrestle with the principalities and powers of the air, to be servants for you, and to trust you to do our duty when you require us to do it, but to never think that we are the reason blessings come. We ask that you would give us patience to wait on your timing and faith to believe that you'll make good on it. And we will rejoice and give you thanks and glory. Prepare us now to worship you and to offer up that thanks through our worship for Jesus Christ's sake. Amen. Thank you.